ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकय चक्षुर्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। ॐ सहना भवतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः।
ओह दैट लुक लाइक द क्राउन वोन बाय द किंग ऑफ इंग्लैंड He suddenly fell off.
No, I looked at him and he kissed my head off.
Yeah. And now I also realize why the kings never bend down or bow down to others.
No, because they had faults.
They had faults off. As an introduction, we might perhaps look at the word Upanishad and spend a little time over what it implies to a student, not to a seeker, but to a student. The Upanishads are considered to be the last portion of the Vedas. I've got a little handbook which says that every branch or every section or chapter of the Veda has got an Upanishad which usually occurs at the end of that chapter. The last portion of that chapter. And therefore it is usual to say that the Upanishad represents Vedanta. The word Vedanta here is taken to mean the end or the last portion of a Vedic text. So we have on the one hand this thing called Vedanta, the last portion of a Vedic text, and the collection of these Vedantic texts is called the Upanishad. Must we follow this traditional interpretation or not? I don't know. Because people often talk of Vedas. You ask any Hindu, they will tell you Vedas are our authority or Vedas are our fundamental scriptures. But you ask them, have you ever looked at the Vedas? Do you know what it means? They say, no. Somebody has read it. My great-grandfather was a Pandit. Or we have a spiritual religious head and he knows all about it. This is not peculiar to the Hindu crowd. I bumped into a similar phenomenon on the part of a Christian. Once we were chatting, a small group of 4 or 5 people, and we were discussing about the evil that prevails in the world and what to do about it. Should we not fight it? And I happened to mention, didn't Jesus Christ say, "He resists not evil"? And one of the ladies, old ladies there, she was a very devout Christian. She was up in arms. She said, "No. Where did you read that? Is it in the Holy Bible?" She hasn't been told that. She was a complete, total stranger to that. And in the same way, on another occasion, I happened to mention that Jesus himself did not consider himself a totally unique person. Because he had said, the works that I have done you can do, and even greater things you can do. And one of the devout Christians in the group who was upset. No, he never said so. I was happy to hear Father Donovan pick that particular passage for the ceremony the other day. It's there in St. John. I didn't know chapter and verse, and so kept quiet. I didn't want to enter into discussion and disputation. Why does this happen? Because we do not bother to acquire first-hand knowledge. We are always content with what someone else says. It makes sense. Why should I bother? I don't know how this tape recorder works, and still I am using it. I know how to use it. I don't know what electricity actually is and how it functions. But I don't bother. All that work has been done by somebody else, and all that I need do is to press the switch and the light comes on. And unfortunately, we apply the same principle to spiritual knowledge or spiritual truth, and here it does not apply. Here you have to learn. You have to do all that the first master did. You have to go through all that he went through, Jesus Christ or Buddha or Yajnavalkya or Vasishtha. You have to do all that. Muktananda, Nityananda is. We will come to that in a minute. So, when we talk about Vedanta, we have precious little idea of what it means. There may be another point of view. There may be another approach to it. And that is merely to translate the words Veda and Anta. Just as if you get hung up on the idea that Bible means this particular book, then you have one approach to it. If you recognize that Bible means book, the word Bible means book, then you enter into a very different dimension. It's a beautiful dimension. You begin to respect and honor and revere all books, not just this book. So that, for instance, brought up in that tradition, to me, it's almost blasphemous to step on even a newspaper. Because it's a printed thing and it is the source of knowledge, whether of the transcendental wisdom or of the neighborhood gossip. It is a source of knowledge, and all source of knowledge is Saraswati, is manifestation of Saraswati. They do that in printing presses, even in India. They may be printing Bhagavad Gita, and if a few sheets of paper fall down, they walk on it. But a devout orthodox person wouldn't do it. Then, we may do it if we make a distinction between a sacred book and a non-sacred book. This is the Bible and therefore I must put it on a pedestal. And this is a book and I can do what I like with it. If you realize that the word Bible means just a book, then perhaps you will learn to respect all books and therefore all sources of knowledge. In the same way, the word Veda means knowledge. Not only a certain type of knowledge, not only knowledge of something considered sacred or holy, but just knowledge. This is mentioned in the Upanishads themselves. When Narada, we don't know whether it is the same sage or someone else, approaches a great sage called Sanat Kumara and says, "Lord, I have studied all the scriptures, but I still have no peace of mind." And the master says, "Come on, tell me what you have read so far." Then he says, "I have read this, I have read that, I have read history, geography, art, science, all sorts of things. All these are considered part of Veda. Veda does not only mean knowledge of the ultimate reality or God, but Veda also includes the science of health, Ayurveda, and the science of warfare, Dhanurveda, Jyotisha, astronomy, astrology, all these." So, Veda means knowledge. But if you take this, adopt this interpretation, you run into some difficulty. What do you do with the other half of the word, anta? Anta means end. Then there are different attitudes possible, different interpretations possible. What is the end? This problem exists both in Sanskrit and in English. So there is no difference here. What is the end of knowledge? The expression, the phrase end of knowledge can mean the goal of knowledge as well as the termination of knowledge. Almost the destruction of knowledge, let's put it rather crudely. One is the goal of knowledge, the other is the destruction of knowledge. Both these interpretations will lead you to exactly the same point. Vedanta here may mean the goal of knowledge. The Upanishads point to the goal of knowledge and they also reveal the destruction of knowledge. That sounds a bit crude. But it is one of those ironies that you cannot destroy something which you do not have. In your hands, somewhere near you. It must have been created, it must have been cherished, and then it can be destroyed. And even so, here, one has to acquire this knowledge, cherish that knowledge, and then let this knowledge come to an end. You must acquire this knowledge, you must cherish that knowledge, and allow that knowledge to come to its own end. That is the goal of knowledge. So, it is end in both senses. It is end in the sense of a goal, it is end in the sense of it's coming to an end. What do we mean by that? When does knowledge come to an end? It comes to an end like the food that is eaten comes to an end. Food that is eaten comes to an end by becoming the body. By becoming the eater, there is a pronouncement in one of the Upanishads, adyateyattica bhutani tasmadannam taduchyata iti. Why is food called annam? And the Maharishi says, adyate atticha, it is eaten and it eats, therefore it is called food, annam. It is eaten and it eats. They have again innumerable interpretations of this phrase, but you can view it in a rather simple way. What is it that eats food? The body. What is the body made of? Eaten food. Food that was eaten some years ago becomes the body and now eats food. It is the eater and it is the eaten. It's both the eater and the food. Eater is the food and food is food. So, that which is being eaten is being eaten by food processed before. The body, the food that has been turned into the body eats more food now, and the end of that food, the goal of that food, is to make the body stronger or more, build the body, is to build the body. That's the goal and the end of food. What is the goal of eating? So that the body may be sustained, nourished. Otherwise you wither away, disappear. So, food builds this body. And thereby destroys itself. The food has to destroy itself in order that it may become flesh. Otherwise, you have indigestion. That is the goal. That is the end. The goal of food is to destroy itself in order that food may be turned into flesh. Can knowledge similarly be made to come to an end so that it becomes the living truth? Then it is Vedanta. That is the goal of knowledge and that is also the end of knowledge. When knowledge comes to an end, it is no longer an intellectual embellishment. It is no longer knowledge held in the brain, in the mind, but it has become living truth. So that it may not even be necessary for you to proclaim, I am a knower of this knowledge, or I am a wise person, I am a person of wisdom. Or you may not even have to discourse upon what is called the living truth or the wisdom of the Upanishads. But your very presence would be illumining, because you are the living truth. Because the knowledge that you acquired through the study of Vedanta, through listening to the teachers and so on, the knowledge that you acquired has come to an end or reached its goal, which is to become the living truth. This is Vedanta. It is, as we saw, called Upanishad. What does Upanishad signify? Upanishad has many meanings, and one interesting meaning is to sit near. And it is very interesting. Those of you who have been to India might realize that in not many ashrams and spiritual institutions would you invariably find at least the master sitting and conducting a class. There may be others who may go on talking. I mean, you have to be entertained. You know, in the ashram in Rishikesh, in the 50s, when foreigners began trickling in, they quickly brought in the criticism. What is this? What's going on here? There's nothing there. There are no classes. Nobody teaches us yoga. Nobody teaches us Vedanta. Everybody is doing some work or the other. And they are even eager to give us some work. We eat and we sleep and we do all these natural things. And there is a puja in the temple, there is something, and there is a satsang. In those days, there were not many speeches in satsang, songs and bhajans and kirtans and so on. We have come all the way from Europe and America and we are not being taught. And then Swami Shivananda asked a few senior Swamis or junior Swamis or even outsiders, visitors, to conduct classes. Come on, you want a class? You'll have them. Then they were worried again, because when you go to those classes, some they go on talking about Adhyatma Ramayana or Bhagavad Gita or some Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. It's so boring that you want to go to sleep. You asked for it. So, what was emphasized was Upanishad, merely sitting near a holy man. It's an extraordinary education if we understand the spirit, otherwise it's useless. Not only because we were fond of him or devoted to him, but because of this factor too, we love to sit near Swami Shivananda. It didn't matter whether he spoke Vedanta or business. Very often it was just plain business or gossip. So, common thing, how are you? How is your wife? And since how long are you growing your moustache? This sort of thing. He would ask anything. Any question. And what do you like for your breakfast? Would you like some coffee or idli? Shall I order something special for you? How do you like the food here? Is it too hot? This sort of thing. What does Australia look like? This sort of talk used to go on. But there was something in the atmosphere, there was something in the personality of Swami Shivananda, that by merely sitting near him, you felt a different being. It's not possible to describe it. And obviously, it was half subjective and half objective. I don't know the proportion. Proportion may vary. It was to be dependent upon both of us. I had to be receptive to that spiritual vibration, and he has to be a master. Then, when we sit near each other, there is transmission of knowledge. Transmission of something. God knows what it is. That is called Upanishad. This does not mean that there should be no dialogue. There might, occasionally, somebody might ask a question. Somebody might come up and say, Swami, my mind is very restless, please bless me. They would even then say, please bless me. Not, my mind is restless, what do you think I should do? Please bless me. And Swamiji might say, oh, it'll be alright. It'll be alright. It'll be alright means anything. It'll be alright. Or he might say, oh, do some japa, more japa. And the dialogue was over. And that was enough. There might be occasional dialogues like this, but that is not important. What was important was sitting near. And that is Upanishad. We'll take up for our study a few different examples of what happens in this sitting near as we go on during our study. But while on this topic of sitting near and dialogue, we might as well look into one of the Shanti mantras, which we often repeat. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahanau Bhunaktu, Sahavirjam Karavavahai, Tejasvina Avadhi, Tamastuma Vidvishavahai, Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Sitting near is not the whole thing. Just as when we sit near each other, we sit on the same platform, on the same level, physically. Psychically or psychologically or spiritually also, we should be on the same dimension. Otherwise, nothing is going to take place. We must be on the same wavelength. You, the guru, may be very strong. I, your student, may be not so strong. But we should be on the same wavelength. You may be more powerful. I may not be so powerful. I may be weak. But we should be on the same wavelength. Which means our goals and our motivations, our ideals must be same. If that is not there, then we don't speak the same language in silence. If that is not there, we won't speak the same language in silence. Verbal communication is all right. We are both taught in the same school, and therefore we understand what the words mean. But non-verbal communication demands attunement, atonement. And therefore, the guru and the disciple start their dialogue with a prayer, Sahana Bhavatu, may God protect both of us, may God bless both of us, Sahana Bhunaktu, may we be enabled to enjoy our togetherness. May there be harmony between us, love between us, affection between us. Sahavirjam karavavahe. Let us not waste our time in idle talk, but let us energetically generate shakti, more energy. Tejasvina avadhi tamastu. And may whatever we study or bring out of this dialogue, may that also be full of shakti. Maavid vishavahe. Let us not quarrel. May we not fight with each other. This shows that even in those days, gurus and disciples used to quarrel, fight. May this not happen to us. Because if we enter into conflict, then the truth suffers. We don't discover the truth. So, Upanishad means sitting together on the same platform and raising ourselves to the same spiritual dimension, so that verbal as well as non-verbal communication might take place. And whether it is verbal or non-verbal, knowledge thus transmitted might eventually reach its goal or come to an end and become the living truth. This is the meaning and sense of the word Upanishad and the word Vedanta. We'll deal with the qualifications of the student. I thought we might finish today. Next week.
वर्धनम् गुरुवारुकम् वन्दनां विद्योर्मुख्यमामुता ॐ त्र्यम्बकम् यजामहे सुगन्धिं पुष्टिवर्धनम् गुरुवारुकम् वन्दनां विद्योर्मुख्यमामुता ॐ त्र्यम्बकम् यजामहे सुगन्धिं पुष्टिवर्धनम् सर्वेषां स्वस्ति भवतु सर्वेषां शान्तिः भवतु सर्वेषां पूर्णं भवतु सर्वेषां मङ्गलं भवतु सर्वे भवन्तु सुखिनः सर्वे सन्तु निरामयः सर्वे भद्राणि पश्यन्तु मा कश्चिदपि भवान् भवेत् असतो मा सत्यमय असमसो मा ज्योतिर्मय नित्यो मा नित्यमङ्गलय ॐ पूर्णमदः पूर्णमिदं पूर्णात् पूर्णमुदच्यते पूर्णस्य पूर्णमादाय पूर्णमेवावशिष्यते ॐ शान्ति सद्गुरुनाथ महाराज की जय.
ईश्वर लेटर.